Well, it's a privilege to be with you today. It's been a blessing already to hear your testimonies, especially testimonies of joy in the midst of hardship and testimonies of God's faithfulness. And I would echo that as well, that God is faithful. Rex could have just kept on going there, I believe. But since he's asked me to share here, I guess I will. I work for Anabaptist Financial. We do quite a few young family finance seminars over the years in various communities, and so some of this material is taken from that. I'm going to be throwing a lot of stuff at you. So if you can just pick up, you know, one or two points that help you in your decision-making in life, why hopefully it will be worth it. Attitudes concerning money and possessions. Well, there's the worldly attitude, one of entitlement. Society owes me a living. And that seems to be a growing attitude in our culture, in our worldly society. It's not fair that you have more than I do. And so we need to redistribute this wealth so that, you know, you owe it to me because you have more than you need. It's based on envy, and unfortunately there's something called the politics of envy. Then there's a mentality, an ownership mentality, that says it's mine because I earned it. And that's also prevalent in the world there. This is the mentality of those who have a lot. And it's based on our selfish nature. I made this, and so it's mine. But I believe the scriptural, godly mentality is a stewardship mentality. That is the idea that it all belongs to God, and Rex already alluded to that. I was amazed about a year ago, we had a seminar, young family finance seminar, usually young people and young marrieds, and a young man came to one of our speakers afterward, and he said he had never heard that concept that God owns it all. That was amazing to me. But here's some statements, some scriptural statements concerning that. Psalm 24:1, the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, the world and they that dwell therein. Haggai 2, the silver and gold is mine, declares the Lord of hosts. Psalm 50:10, for every beast of the forest is mine, the cattle on a thousand hills. Verse 12, if I were hungry, I would not tell thee, for the world is mine and the fullness thereof. And I think that that's a concept we need to keep in our minds continually, that it really all belongs to God. Why does it belong to God? Well, first of all, because God made it. By him were all things created. We know that. All things were created by him. Now, suppose they were in the midst of the Amazon jungle. An extraordinary, beautiful flower with a heavenly aroma, but it was never seen by any person, never appreciated by any person. Wouldn't that be kind of a waste of God's creative energy to make something that no one has ever seen? Well, the answer comes to us in Revelation 4:11. Thou art worthy, O Lord, to receive glory and honor and power, for thou hast created all things, and for thy pleasure they were and are created. And so if there is something like that, the vastness of outer space, the smallest thing, or the flower in the jungle, God knows it's there and he enjoys it. He made it first of all for himself to enjoy. But God is a generous God, and God graciously allows us to use his things and share in his things. God is not selfish with his creation. We trust in the living God who giveth us richly all things to enjoy. So the natural world in which God has made, he has made it first of all for himself, but then he shares with us. What a generous God we serve. Way back in the garden already, God gave Adam dominion over the resources of the earth, but he did not give him ownership thereof. God maintains owner. We are the stewards. There is an absentee factor. Jesus is not here. Jesus has returned to heaven, and he's kind of, in a sense, left us in charge. You know, the parable of the talents and the parable of the pounds. The master dealt out the talents and then left and then came back again. We don't clock in and report directly to Jesus every day, but he has given us principles to live by. The kingdom of heaven is as a man traveling into a far country, calling his own servants and deliver them his goods. So God has delivered some goods to you. Maybe you have the five talents. Maybe you have the one talent. But God has delivered something to you that he expects you to use. With that, there is a responsibility. All right, there is a responsibility factor. God has entrusted his goods to us to use, and he expects us to use them wisely. Occupy until I come. What does it mean to occupy? Occupy means that what God gives us, We don't just fold in a napkin and bury it, but we put it to use so that it increases. Occupy means to work, to increase, to bring a betterment. The use it or lose it is a scriptural concept. Do you ever think about the difference between a garden and a jungle? What's the difference between a jungle and a garden? Well, the only difference really is the involvement of mankind. The jungle can support, an acre of jungle can support, you know, a number of birds and some monkeys and maybe a couple people. But if you take that same acre and man gets involved and tills it, he can make it much, much more productive than it is in its natural sense. And I believe there's a sense in which God, that's part of what it means to occupy until he comes, to utilize the resources that God has given us and bring betterment with them. Then there's expectations and commitments on both sides. Even back in the days of slavery in America, there was expectations on the master side, and there was expectations on the slave side. The master expected, you know, a good day's work from his slave, but the slave in turn expected that the master provides him with food, clothing, and a place to live. And so, there's certain things that God expects of us, and there's actually expectations that we have of God as well. What has God committed to us? What do we commit to God? Well, he has committed to us the word of reconciliation, and we in turn, we have committed the keeping of our souls to him, among other things. So who do you think it takes the greatest risk in what we commit? God and what he commits to us, or we and what we commit to God? Well, the answer is obvious. What we commit to God is fully, totally secure. But God takes a risk when he entrusts us with his things. And, So a day of reckoning is coming. The master in the parable returned. And Jesus is coming back sometime again. We must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, that everyone may receive the things done in his body according to what he has done. Judgment in the final end is according to works, not faith. The test of our stewardship is not what we believe, but what we do. Yes, we come to God, and our relationship with God is based on grace through faith. But in the end, the test is, what did you do with that? The Son of Man shall come in his glory with his Father and his angels. They shall reward every man according to his works. See, he gave up the dead in them. Death and hell delivered the dead which were in them. They were judged every man according to their works. So, do works matter? Yeah. Yes, our faith needs to be strong in God, but God is looking for works to come out of that faith. So to have is to owe, not to own. We owe everything to God. And the purpose of stewardship is building and testing character. In a lot of our business seminars and family finance seminars, we talk about the wealth in our community. I'm assuming this is not one of the most wealthy group in among our circles. But, you know, is wealth a blessing or a curse? And I maintain it's neither, but it's a test of character. How do you use what God has given you? Stewardship involves more than money. But it involves time and talent, but this session is focused on the physical or the monetary aspect of it. Basically, three things we can do with our financial resources. We can give them away, we can spend it, we can save it. And probably most of us do a combination of all three. But we want to look at some principles involved in each of these three as we go through this session. Hopefully there's enough in your budget to do some of all three, to save some, to give some, and to have some to spend. First of all, the principles of giving. You know, teaching on tithing is kind of all over the map in our circles. We're not sure whether we should teach tithing or if tithing is part of the Old Testament, is it part of the New Testament? Does the New Testament teach tithing? Well, I'd like to suggest that tithing is a benchmark that was given way back before the law, and it kind of carries through the rest of Scripture, and I believe it carries through in our day today. Tithing, I think, is a great place to start in our giving. And with our children, I think, especially, it's good that we teach them. When they earn money, we put aside, out of every $10, we put aside a dollar for God. Develop that mentality when our children are small, and then it can go with them as they grow through life. The church I grew up at Weavertown, we had an elderly widow years ago. She was having some financial problems, so she asked the church for help. So a deacon and another brother went to see her, and as they looked over her checkbook ledger and her expenses there, noticed she was giving very little to the church. And the deacon mentioned something about that, and she said, well, you know, until I have all my other expenses paid, there's just not much left. Well, this deacon brother said, would you be willing to try something? Would you be willing to put aside 10% of your income first for the church and for the Lord, and then we'll help you budget your other expenses on the 90%? Well, she wasn't quite sure, but agreed to try it. I think it was for like 6 months. And after 6 months, they came back to visit her again, and she was quite excited. She said, I don't know what happened, but it just seems that it's easier to pay my bills now with the 90% than it was before with the 100%. And I believe God has ways of doing that. When we honor the Lord, I believe God has ways of stretching our dollars and making them go further than we ever imagined. On the other hand, when we live selfishly and stingily, I think it's also possible that God puts holes in our pockets and the end of the month comes. The end of the money comes before the end of the month, and we wonder where it went, what happened. And so I'd encourage you, you know, not in a legalistic sense, but just in out of a heart of generosity, to put God first in our giving. And really, 10% is kind of a biblical base mark to which to begin. Tithing reminds that it really all belongs to God. He graciously allows us to use his resources. What if you can't afford to tithe? Well, maybe you can't afford not to tithe. Yeah, the New Testament says, the New Testament does not command tithing as such, except that Jesus talked about it, talking to the Pharisees. You tithe of mint and almond, all the leaves of your garden, and you omit the weightier matters of the law, righteousness, justice, and truth. And so tithing, Jesus said at the end, and he says, this you ought to have done and not leave the other undone. So Jesus does suggest that tithing is something that should be done, but it's maybe not on the top priority. Our relationship with other people is more important than making sure that we tithe every last dollar that comes into our pocket. Giving should be done voluntarily and cheerfully, not grudgingly. People often grumble about paying taxes. Giving is not like paying taxes and shouldn't be viewed as such. Rather, I think giving should be viewed as an opportunity, not an obligation. We don't give because of law, because we have to, but because of love. And I think the attitudes involved in our giving are so important in God's sight. We give cheerfully. Anonymous giving, I think we're all aware of that, something that is taught in our circles quite often. Well, systematically, upon the first day of the week, let every one of you lay by him in store. On a regular, systematic basis. The paycheck comes in, first thing we do is put aside for the Lord the 10% that belongs to him, and then go from there. Give proportionally. Our readiness is present, is acceptable according to what a person has, not according to what he does not have. There again, I won't be absolutely adamant in saying everybody must tithe. I think this scripture here would say you give according to what you have. But again, I think the basis, the bottom line there, should be 10% if at all possible. Tithing is a proportional way of giving. I maintain that tithing is a good place to start in our giving, but if the Lord increases our income a great deal, I don't think it's a good place to stop. I was talking to a young man some time ago, an ambitious guy. He loves to make money, and he's going to make a lot of money in his life. And he was telling me No, his goal is to be able to tithe $100,000. I said, oh, you aiming to make $1 million a year? He said, yep. I said, you know, if you make $1 million a year, I'm not sure the Lord would be terribly impressed with a $100,000 tithe. Again, tithing is a place to start, but not a place to stop. We give with purpose. Every man as he purposes in his heart, so let him give. Giving should be done not just on an emotional basis, not just when you feel like it, but make a rational decision. This is what I'm going to do on a regular basis, and give with purpose. Give responsibly. Be careful who you give to. Don't give to causes that you don't know anything about. We have an example of that in Acts 11, when the churches up north sent their offering by the hands of Barnabas and Saul, men that they knew and trusted, to take it down to the church, the needs in Judea. Sacrificial giving. Rex mentioned that as well already. The poor widow who gave all her living. What do you think happened to her after she gave those last 2 mites? I often wonder. You think she starved? I don't think so. In fact, when I get to heaven, I'm going to go knock on her door. I'm going to say, you know, what happened to you after you gave those last 2 mites? I think she might have some interesting stories to tell us about how God provided for her in a miraculous way. I believe God, when we give sacrificially, God can act in ways that he never acts to those of us who simply give out of our abundance. Give yourself. This maybe should be first, but God is more interested in you than he is in your money. And unless God has you first, your money really doesn't count a whole lot. All right, so much for giving. How about saving? Principles of saving. Well, we certainly can't ignore the words of Jesus when he said, lay not up for yourselves treasures on earth. You know, wealth has a way of growing tentacles that wrap around our hearts in such a way that it becomes the focus of our life. And I believe that's what Jesus is saying, that wealth, don't let wealth entangle your heart and ensnare your heart. And so the resources that God gives us, I think, should be viewed as resources rather than treasures or rather than security. They are resources. God puts them into our hand, and they need to be held with an open hand, lest they ensnare our heart. But there are some principles other in Scripture that would indicate that saving is a good thing. Proverbs 21:20 says, there's treasure to be desired and oil in the dwelling of the wise, but a foolish man spendeth it up. And so the principle is, don't spend all that you have. In some of our poorer countries, a dollar in hand is a dollar to be spent. They have no concept of saving. So when you have $50 in your pocket and you go to town, go shopping, doesn't mean you need to spend all the $50. In fact, if you do that consistently, Proverbs says that's foolish. All the money in your pocket is to be spent. No, save some for later. Principle of the ant. The ant's not very big. Doesn't have a very big brain. Doesn't really have a lot of leadership there. And yet, they're out there in the summertime, slaving away, knowing they're trimming the walks, and you see the ants busy dragging the stuff bigger than themselves, taking it into their house, down underground for their home. Pretty smart. Principle is to save in times of plenty for times of leanness. The old saying is, make hay while the sun shines. It's actually a Bible principle. And we in our circles, we do a lot of freezing and a lot of canning. That's based on the principle of the ant. It's a great thing. It's a great way to provide for the winter. We know the winter's coming. We know we're not going to get stuff out of our garden in the winter. And so we prepare ahead for what we know is coming. A principle of saving from the ant. Story of Joseph in Egypt. Time of plenty and a time of scarcity. Life has its cycles. There are booms and there are busts. We've largely been living in pretty good times in the last while. Seems like the economy is maybe a little sluggish right now. I talked to various businessmen. Things are a little slow this year. They're still okay, but they're not what they were a couple years ago. We can be sure that things will not always be riding the crest. Someday there will be a downturn. And then what? If we're used to living high on the hog at good times, we may have trouble when the poor times come. Recognize that cycles happen. Economic cycles of boom and bust. Joseph wisely laid up good in the good times for the bad times that were coming. There's a growing season. There's a dormant season. We lay up in harvest for the winter on a yearly basis, but also think about that on a longer term basis of the economic cycles as well. 20% of Americans have no savings. 40% have less than $1,000 in savings. In essence, half of Americans would be in a pretty bad bind if they were hit with an unexpected $1,000 bill. I hope we're not average Americans. I hope we've been taught financial principles and have learned to save over the years, and so that we would have a bit more than the average American. Why save? Well, we save for emergencies. We don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. We don't know if we're going to lose our job, or one of the children gets sick, or breaks an arm, or medical expense comes up. We know that unexpected things do happen. And so I think it's wise to have an emergency fund. How much should you have? Well, we say 3 months of lean living expenses on hand. That's cut out the fat out of your budget, the eating out and all the extras. What does it take you to live in an average month and have at least that much laid aside for an emergency fund? And then when the emergency comes, then don't be afraid to pull those funds either. Some people are reluctant to do that, but that's what they're for. Emergencies happen. We don't know when, but they will happen. But there are some things that we do know. There are bills that are going to be coming down the road that you know. The phone bill, the electric bill, taxes if you own your property, vehicle costs, housing. Some of these are due on a monthly basis, some semi-annually, some annually. But you know, you should have a good idea what is coming down the road on a regular basis. You should also know about what it's going to take. How much is it going to take when I go to the grocery store next week? How much is my phone bill going to be this month, my electric bill? If you have a mortgage, you should know for sure what your mortgage is. That's pretty much standard all the time. But this comes into the area of budgeting that I'm not going to hit a lot on, but maybe mention a little bit later. So why save? Well, we save for emergencies. We save for anticipated expenses and replacement items. We live in a world full of friction in more ways than one, and those things wear out. They need to be replaced, and replacements are expensive. You all know about that. And finally, we save for old age. Saving for old age is not just necessarily so we have the good life in old age, but because the reality is, as we get older, our health sometimes begin to fail. We can't work as much as we did, or maybe we can't work at all. And then what? Well, if you have Social Security, maybe the government will help you. If you don't have Social Security, what are you going to do? Maybe the church will help you. But I think most of us don't want to be a burden to our families or our churches, and don't want to rely on the government more than we have to. So maybe it's not a bad idea to put some in saving as we go along for that old age. Old age will come if you live long enough. But how do you go about it? What if you're on a tight budget? Your income is limited. How are you going to save? Well, I would suggest do it regularly, even if it's just a little bit, $5 or $10 a week, or even a month on a regular basis, adds up after a while. I think it's good in our saving to set goals that are attainable. It feels good to have a goal and then attain that goal, rather than setting the goal too high and then, I couldn't attain that and feel a little down because of that. Make your goal attainable. Keep it low enough so that you can attain it and maybe even exceed it. It feels good when we can exceed our goals sometimes, especially when it comes to saving. And I think it's good to become a habitual saver. And again, we talked about children. I was amazed at the amount of children here. You as single parents, I think you can have a responsibility in teaching them how to handle finances as well. And again, one of the things is to teach them to tithe, put aside 10% for God. And in childhood and early youth, I think saving is important. Maybe save 50%. In children's lives, I think 50% is not unreasonable. And then they still have a little spritzwechsel to spend on some things that they would like to have themselves. But the emphasis for children should be giving and saving and not just spending everything that comes into their hands. And I suggest that you do your saving first. That is after tithing. Don't wait until all the other bills are paid, see how much you have left. Pay yourself first. It's one of the secrets of wealth management from way, way back, is that you give God his share first, pay yourself second, and then live on what's rest. A goal that some people have is the 80-10-10 rule. And I think it's a good goal. I think a young person starting out, following a young couple, especially starting out with the 80-10-10 rule, will probably not have a lot of financial stress in life. 80-10-10 rule is simply you give 10%, save 10%, and learn to live on the other 80%. The 80-10-10 rule is a good goal to aim for. You can automate your savings when you deposit your check. Have the bank immediately take out X number of dollars and put it into your savings account. You'll never miss it. You don't know what happened, but your savings will continue to grow. You don't have to do anything with it, and they'll take care of it for you. And I think that's a good way to save. How to save? Well, use a budget. A budget doesn't make your money go any further, doesn't add any wealth to your money, but it does help you to see where the money is going. It'd be interesting if I'd ask you how many of you have a written budget. I'm not going to ask that. But you should, in your back of your mind, you should have a good idea of how much money you have and what the expenses are that's coming up. If you don't have that good idea of that in your mind, then you need to start writing it down. Budgets are very helpful, especially on tight incomes, is that you know. If you have budgeted your income and you put aside so much for groceries every month, you look at your budget, I have X number of dollars that I have to go and buy my groceries. And you get to the store, you don't have to wonder, well, how much money do I have to spend? You know. You know what your housing costs are. You really should have a good idea of what the basic costs are for you to live. Write it down. Accurate records of your finances. A shoebox full of receipts is not accurate records. You need to know where your money is going if you're going to be successful financially. We already talked about the 80-10-10 rule. Spending considerations. All right, so we talked about giving and saving. What about spending? Well, this is usually the kicker. It's usually not our lack of income that gets us in trouble. It's our overspending. And there's one surefire way of avoiding financial disaster or financial trouble. It's as simple as can be. You don't spend more than you make. Spend less than you make, and you'll be fine. The problem is with easy credit today, credit cards, bank loans, so easy to borrow the money, get what you want, and then end up head over heels in debt. Discern between what and need. Is this something I really need, or is it just something that I want? And avoid impulsive buying, especially stuff that you don't really need. I think it's always a good idea to sleep over sleep a night before you make a major purchase. Been kind of a policy that we did, buying something like a vehicle or some big purchase. We never buy the first time we go. You want to sleep over. It's amazing how much a night of sleep can change one's perspective. All of a sudden, what you thought you needed so badly doesn't look so necessary after all. Don't use shopping as a hobby. Well, the girls, we need something to do today. Well, let's go shopping. That doesn't seem like a very smart thing to do as a hobby. I think there's maybe more worthwhile hobbies to have than shopping. If that shopping is your hobby and you can control your spending, God bless you. But, the temptation to spend money is there right in front of you, unnecessarily. Shop with a list. Shop with a list and then stick to it. Use a list, whether shopping groceries or clothing or anything else. Nothing is cheap if you don't need it. Yeah, take advantage of sales if you need the item, but don't buy something just because it's on sale. Nothing is cheap if you don't need it. And grocery items, they say, generally come around on sale about every 6 to 8 weeks. So if something's on sale here, and that's really a good buy, but I don't really need it, a pretty good supply, don't just stock up more of that. Wait for another 6 or 8 weeks, and it'll probably come up on sale again. Watch your coupons. And by all means, take advantage of sales, but only if you need it. Back to the idea of shopping with a list. My wife is a great list maker. She has lists for everything, and it is so helpful. If she goes shopping, she's got everything on a list. That's what she buys. Unless I'm along. And that's not her fault. Buy generic rather than brand names. Just one example is Walmart's Great Value products. Yeah, a can of beans might be 29, 39 cents less Great Value than the brand name. What's 29 or 39 cents? No big deal. Well, until you start looking at it from a percentage standpoint, then maybe it can become a bigger deal. That 39 cents might be 10 or 15%. If you could reduce your entire budget by 10 or 15%, would you do it? I hope you would. And so think about those kind of purchases maybe on a percentage basis rather than just the cents involved. And it might look like a better deal. Buy only what you can eat. Keep spoilage to a minimum. Every time you throw out spoiled food, you're throwing money down the drain. And so even if something's on sale, just buy what you need so that you don't end up throwing a lot of stuff away. Enjoy leftovers. Y'all have leftovers sometimes? You eat your leftovers? I maintain that if it was good the first time, it can be good the second time. Not sure about the third time. But I enjoy leftovers. My wife, she only cooks like 2 or 3 times a week, and then we eat leftovers the rest of the time, and I'm perfectly fine with that. Perfectly fine with that. I pity those who hate leftovers and end up throwing them away. Did you ever think about curbside pickup for shopping? Walmart does that. And the big advantage of that is that you call in your order beforehand and you get the total, how much this is going to be. You don't have to pick all the stuff off the shelf and not know what it's going to cost you until you check out. You know beforehand what it's going to cost you. And I think there's some wisdom to that, especially if your budget is tight. You know exactly what it's going to cost you. And a lot of times, curbside service is free at a lot of stores, and it's another way. It's another one of those factors that you can use to keep your budget in check. Realize that eating out is a very expensive way to eat. Did you know that? Eating out is a very expensive way to eat. It costs you 4 to 5 times more than eating at home. year or so ago, Sarah had made a nice meal for us, some meatloaf and some peas and scalloped potatoes and a salad. It was all very good. And I said, you know, I just wonder what this meal is costing us. So we pulled out the calculator and did a little figuring there, and it was enough of goods for us to have one meal and then a meal of leftovers. There's enough meatloaf, and I think enough of the peas were left as well, and the potatoes. And so we got four meals out of that, and we figured that that whole meal cost us just a little over $6. It's a little over around $1.50 a meal. Well, you go to a restaurant to buy that same meal, well, you're talking $12, $15, maybe $20. There is a huge difference between eating out or eating at home, and especially if you're feeding children. The other day, Sarah and I stopped at McDonald's, and what did we get? Yeah, I got a Big Mac, and she got a quarter pounder, and we each got a milkshake. It was a little over $20. We didn't even have to get any fries. That's my fault. I'm not a big fry person. $20 at McDonald's for the two of us. You take a family of three or four or five children to McDonald's, now you're looking at $50, $60. Eating out is expensive. That doesn't mean that you can't do it once in a while if you have it in your budget. Talking to another young man not long ago, asking if he does budgeting, he says, absolutely. He said, it's my hobby. Oh, this guy's got his ducks in a row. He's got his act together. Yeah, he said, my wife loves it. She knows exactly how much money she has to spend when she goes shopping. And we budget eating out 2 times a month. And we do it without feeling guilty because we have it in our budget. And so if you can budget your money in such a way that allows for eating out once a month or so, enjoy. But be sure that it's in the budget. This whole thing of eating out is a rather recent phenomenon. When I was growing up, we never went out to eat unless we were traveling. Restaurants were for travelers. They weren't for people at home. And I remember my grandparents, we lived there in Burdenham Intercourse area, and one evening they decided they're going to go to Gaiman's Diner over on Route 30 just to eat out. And people said, it's ridiculous. Why go to eat out when you can eat at home? Well, how our mentality has changed. And of course, culture norms, do they affect us? Well, of course they do. And so now we think we have to go eat out too, even when we're at home. How things have changed. Credit card use. Well, credit cards are mighty handy, but they're also mighty dangerous. Did you know that if you want to save money, buy with cash. You will save money by using cash rather than a credit card. Involved in a business for a while, and we didn't take credit cards, and the company came in and tried to set us up with credit cards. They said, you can expect your customers will spend 18% more when they use credit cards. And other studies show the same thing. You spend more if you use a credit card. For instance, you're going to Boscov's there. Oh, here's this nice sweater on sale for $39. $79 marked down to $39. And I have two $20 bills in my pocket. Am I willing to part with those two $20 bills for that sweater? Not sure. But if you pull out your credit card, I get the sweater, and I still have those two $20 bills in my pocket. Easy peasy. Yeah. If you're really tight, use cash. This is a study in 2016. The average credit card transaction was $57. The average cash transaction, $22. Again, an indication that every time you whip out that credit card, it's so much easier than pulling cash out of your pocket. There's something about having that money actually disappear from your hand, that you see it, compared to putting it on a credit card, which you don't see until later. It's harder to pull out those 20s in your wallet than pulling out a card. And there's no question about it. You will spend more using a card than cash. If you use a card, always pay it off in full. Never, never, never allow credit card debt. You know what credit card interest rates are? 18, 20, 21%? More than that?
25.
25, wow. That's a killer. And so please, if you use a credit card, always pay it off in full. If you get to the point where you cannot pay off your credit card some month in full, do something about it. Either get rid of the card or find an accountable partner. One of the things we suggest is take your bank statement and your credit card statement and the credit card, give it to someone that you know and trust, maybe your deacon or a good friend that you know and trust, and tell them, hey, look, I'm giving this to you, and you're going to keep it until I can come back with another statement that shows I have paid everything off. Please, don't allow credit card debt. Develop simple tastes and simple lifestyle. That's one thing that I really appreciate about our heritage, is that we don't have to have a lot of fancy stuff in order to be accepted among ourselves, among our people. Don't have to spend for jewelry and hairstyling and all that kind of stuff. That stuff's expensive. And a simple lifestyle is so helpful when it comes to spending. Do you ever try fasting? Fasting is it's good for the spirit, good for the soul, good for the body, and it's good for the pocketbook. There for a while, for about a year, Sarah and I fasted every Monday evening, and we found that fasting in the evening works pretty good. Skip a supper, have breakfast and lunch, and then skip supper. And so your main hunger time is through the night when you're sleeping. Wake up the next morning, you're ready for a good breakfast. That has worked well for us. We don't do it quite as often as we used to. Fasting a whole day is better yet. That takes a lot of discipline for me to fast for a whole day. But if you can do it, again, it's good for your spirit, your soul, your body, and your pocketbook. Fasting is one of those neglected exercises among us, I think. And so in conclusion, I would suggest that we develop a spirit of contentment. A spirit of contentment is such a beautiful thing, to be content with what God has given us. Some are content with little, and some are discontent with much. And some of the people I have admired the most in my lifetime is those who have little but are living rich, fulfilled lives of contentment. They're creative in what they do. They're not lacking as far as expensive trips and eating out and all that kind of stuff. All kinds of things you can do in your backyard and in the neighboring woods and in the state parks. It doesn't cost much and brings tremendous diversity and dimension to a family's life. Rex alluded to this already too. My God shall supply all your needs according to his riches and glory by Christ Jesus. I believe that God promises enough. Enough is a good word. Maybe sometimes enough, my definition of that is not the same as God's, but I believe God provides enough. Moreover, it is required in stewards that a man be found faithful. And that's what I wish for each one of you, that you are faithful with what God has entrusted you.